Introducing Jungian Perspectives, Conversations in Depth, a podcast offered by the journal Psychological Perspectives, a quarterly journal of Jungian thought. Psychological Perspectives is a beautiful journal whose mission is to promote greater consciousness by honoring and amplifying the psychology of C.G. Jung. The journal has been published since 1970, sponsored by the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles. Jung said, "In the same way that the body needs food, and not just any kind of food, but only that which suits it, the psyche needs to know the meaning of its existence. Not just any meaning, but the meaning of those images and ideas which reflect its nature and which originate in the unconscious." Jung was fascinated by every aspect of the psyche and its relationship with the outer world. That fascination led him to explore not only dreams and fantasies, but also mythology and fairy tales, philosophy and fiction, as well as the leading science of his day, from anthropology to nuclear physics. Anything that touched on the psyche was his field of interest, and ours as well. Psychological Perspectives publishes a wide range of articles, from depth psychology to science, from politics to philosophy, as well as fiction, poetry, and current book, video, and film reviews. Each issue is a feast, not only for the mind, but for the eye as well, filled with art that flows from the cover through the articles. On our new Jungian Perspectives podcast, we choose an article once a month from the journal archives and invite the author to speak with us more intimately and in depth. We offer you the chance to explore with us what relevance and meaning the Jungian perspective might have for your personal life and our collective life today. Welcome to Jungian Perspectives, Conversations in Depth.
I'm Thomas Elsner, Jungian analyst, where we get to know and go deeper in with the authors who contribute articles, poetry, and art to Psychological Perspectives, a quarterly journal of Jungian thought. The podcast is co-sponsored by the Los Angeles Jung Institute and the C.G. Jung Study Center of Southern California, and funded by the generosity of the Earthways Foundation, devoted to promoting sustainable vision and action for the earth and humanity, a vision for the future that all living things can share. Today, we have with us Elliot Morgan. Elliot is a stand-up comedian, an actor, and internet personality, as well as a PhD student studying depth psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute. His article, entitled Sacred Skies, UFOs and the Religious Function of the Psyche, that we will be discussing with him today, can be found in the Psychological Perspectives issue entitled Divine Darkness, which is volume 66, issue 3, from 2023. So today I have the great privilege of exploring this fascinating article with the author himself. Before we get to know Elliot, however, and hear from him directly, I'd like to offer some of my thoughts, some background behind why we invited Elliot and where we might go today with our conversation. The subject of UFOs is timely. In July of this year, for instance, 2023, last year now, a first ever congressional hearing on UFOs, or as they are now called UAPs, Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon, held by a House Oversight Subcommittee, hosted three high-ranking and highly credible witnesses, members of the military, two pilots, and one former U.S. intelligence official, who gave testimony under oath about their personal experience and knowledge of UAPs. David Grush, an intelligence officer for 14 years and a whistleblower through the Office of the Inspector General, told this congressional panel he is, quote, absolutely, unquote, certain that the federal government is in possession of UAPs, citing interviews he said he conducted with 40 witnesses over a four-year period. As distinct, however, from the focus of the congressional hearing, namely whether UAPs exist and what they might be, Elliot Morgan follows in the footsteps of Jung as he focuses on what he calls the enchantment around UFOs. Included in that enchantment is the dark side of the phenomenon as it appears in the stigmas of madness, lunacy, and impossibility, as well as conspiratorial government cover-ups and potential mass panic. The enchantment, Morgan suggests, may be the psycho-spiritual dimension of what he calls a living myth or a desire to make contact with the numinous, understood as a kind of holy terror, awe, or dread in a culture for whom God is dead. UFOs open, in Eliot's words, the only thing that remains constant in our modern Western culture as the very thing we have sought to eradicate, mystery. All right. Well, there's a lot there to get into and unpack today, Eliot. But before we jump in, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your studies at Pacifica, and how you got interested in this phenomenon in the first place.
Sure. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me. This is very cool. Congrats on launching this podcast. I have some notes on your guests so far, but you know, we can talk about that. It's my my fault, I guess. As you're reading that, I was like, man, these are some really smart people, especially all like the congressional stuff. I'm like, oh man, I'm really out of my depth here. But yeah, thank you for having me. My name is Eliot Morgan. I'm from Florida originally. I've been living in Los Angeles for probably the past 15 years. I got my start on the internet doing a thing called SourceFed, which was a YouTube kind of comedy news channel before we had, you know, social media influencers. I was part of like the first or second generation of YouTubers, I guess, before that was like a real thing. And since then, I've been able to do things like stand up. I started a company with some of my friends about 5 years ago. We had some success. And then after COVID hit, I decided to kind of pivot. I felt like I'd been doing comedy for a while, and it really felt like it was kind of baseless or just sort of egocentric, and it felt like I didn't really have a perspective. It felt like I was just kind of chasing punchlines, and it felt stale. And I was probably in my, I don't know, I've been like 35, I guess. And so my therapist recommended Pacifica, and I looked up this program, and it is the Depth Psychology with specialization in Jungian psychology and archetypal studies. And when I saw it, I was like, I gotta do it. And I thought, well, this will take probably several years, and it's going to be a big commitment in many ways. And something in me was just like, this is everything I want to learn. I studied zoology in college, so I had this kind of science background. I had an artistic background, but a friend of mine, one of my best friends, is a philosopher. He's a Lacanian, a Freudian. And through him, I kind of found Jung and then this program. And I was like, okay, this is stuff that like I know for the rest of my life I will be curious about. And so rather than kind of just, you know, take from here and there, if I can find a curriculum and dive into it for a while, I was like, this is going to be, I think, worthwhile. And it appears to have been. So that's kind of where I'm at now. I'm in my first year still, technically, of dissertation work.
Great. That's super interesting. Yeah. So your work at Pacifica has enabled you to dive into these subjects that sound like you've been interested in for a while.
For sure. And a lot, I want to say it started with synchronicities, and I didn't even know what that word was probably, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, but there were ones that were so powerful, and I would talk about them on podcasts. And I remember some comments from our audience being, you know, informing me like, this is what it's called. And it kind of piqued my interest. And that kind of, yeah, it was also part of a little bit of a snowball, I guess.
Interesting. How about the UFO phenomenon? You want to say a little bit about how that started for you, what piqued your interest, how you got into this?
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, it was definitely the 2017 New York Times article by Leslie Kean, and I believe Blumenthal is his name. So that was the initial thing. And then I went and had beers with a former pastor of mine. He's still a pastor, but he's not mine anymore. And we would get together and hang out. And I like offhandedly mentioned kind of getting interested in UFOs. And it turned out that he was just like an expert, and I was a brand new, you know, initiate or whatever. And he recommended two books to me. One was The Supernatural, two words, Supernatural, by Jeffrey Kripal and Whitley Strieber. And then the second book was American Cosmic by D.W. Pasulka. And the Supernatural book kind of blew me away because I'd never read a book like that. And this was before going to Pacifica or anything like that. And I was brand new. And so the idea that you could have someone like Whitley Strieber, who wrote Communion, and these sort of like incredibly fantastic, weird stories about, you know, waking up and there being little blue men around his bed. And then you had Jeffrey Kripal, who in the next chapter would academically kind of go through what he was talking about and explain it in different ways. I was like, this is just like fascinating. And that kind of broke open, I think, all of my interest in it. And since then, I'll like dive into the forums and on Reddit and all that. And the community itself, I think, is about as interesting as the phenomenon, because these folks are from all walks of life to varying degrees of commitment to the subject. And, you know, it's an endless journey. And so to this day, I'm like, I do believe ufology is probably like one of the more interesting subjects in the world, no matter your opinion on it. It's just, I think anybody can dive in and go, okay, there is something about this, even if you don't, if you're the most materialist person in the world. So, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, I absolutely agree. I mean, whether the phenomenon is real factually, wow, that's a huge discovery. Whether it's all a delusion, wow, that's a huge discovery. Or whether there's something in the middle that we don't understand yet, that's a huge discovery too. That's where I kind of come from with it. And I know in your article, Sacred Skies, the position you take, having studied depth psychology, is following Jung to focus mostly on the psychological, symbolic, or religious dimensions of the phenomenon and bracket the factual reality for the moment, which is something we can get into as well during this interview.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So maybe we can just start with that. You know, as you say in your article, Jung wrote a book in 1959 called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. And so in preparation for this interview, I reread that book, and it was pretty amazing to reread. I mean, there are two conclusions I came to immediately. Was one, Jung was really interested in the subject. Two, he knew a lot about it. He says in the book that since 1947, he basically read everything he could get his hands on.
Yep.
1947 was Roswell and other incidents like that. So he was working on this subject for 12 years before he published the book. So I thought we might read the first paragraph from Jung's book, and maybe that can be an entree into, you know, this Jungian depth psychological position.
Perfect.
Here's the first paragraph from Jung's book. The worldwide rumor about flying saucers presents a problem that challenges the psychologist for a number of reasons. The primary question, and apparently this is the most important point, is this: are they real or are they mere fantasy products? This question is by no means settled yet. If they are real, exactly what are they? If they're a fantasy, why should such a rumor exist? So what I'd like to ask you is, what do you think Jung means by this idea of a visionary rumor? Or we might also say, in my opinion, a modern legend. You know, a legend is different than a fairy tale or a myth. It's described as something that actually happened. This weird thing happened to Joe Smith. You can go ask him about it. You know, that's different than a fairy tale that happened once upon a time, or a myth that happens in another world somewhere. So, you know, maybe this will get us into the meat of your article. What would you say is the psychic cause and the meaning of the UFO phenomenon as a visionary legend, or a rumor, as Jung calls it?
Yeah, I think I'm really interested also to hear more about what you were saying regarding the legend versus myth versus fairy tale, because I hadn't heard that delineation before, and I really like that. Super interesting. In terms of a visionary rumor as well, I mean, what came to mind there was Hermes. And in my mind, and I think this goes to the final question that you asked, with the UFO phenomenon, it seems to me that there is definitely it. You can think of it as a rumor or whatever word you want to use, if you want to be conspiracy theory or whatever. There's like a purpose behind it. There's something, and as opposed to a regular rumor, which can be like self-aggrandizing, or it's for your own kind of satisfaction, kind of gossipy, whatever, which is great. But like a visionary rumor is like you're part of a current that's happening. Like there's something in the culture going on that is causing this in some way to manifest. And I think that's what's going on, basically. I mean, in my mind, because I don't think you have to be a Jungian or any particular kind of person to feel right now a kind of tension in the culture. And I think Jung also was kind of referencing the same thing at that time, post-World War II and all that. And so people were looking for a kind of supernatural thing, a kind of new myth or a new meaning-making thing. And I think we're past the point where technology is not going to in some way like be a part of that. Because I mean, AI, you have people who, and I'm not like, you know, a super paranoid about AI. I don't think it's going to like destroy everything, but the people who do, there's a reverence to AI. They're like, technology and the internet is becoming its own kind of God. And I think that the UFO is kind of like it's a technological thing, but it's also potentially not. It can function as both. Like that is, I think, the kind of paradoxical core of the whole thing that kind of blows apart most people's typical Cartesian reality.
Yeah, really interesting. Right. As Jung was saying, and I think you're saying too, in the modern world for which God is dead for most people, or traditional religious forms don't have meaning and zap and life and juice anymore. What happens to the religious instinct? What happens to the need to find meaning? And there's sacred skies. There's always been sacred things seen in the skies. And I guess what you're saying is today that takes a technological, you know, form for us.
Totally. Yeah. It seems like it's just funneling into a new kind of, like, no one wants to believe in like an invisible. I mean, I'm speaking at potentially at a turn because I'm also coming from Los Angeles and my friends are pretty rational people and they're not so into this, you know, the quote unquote weird stuff. But no one wants to really believe that there's like an invisible sky dad who is up above, who is detached from, you know, the actual nitty gritty life. And I don't think that we have the luxury of believing that anymore. And so the UFO just seems like a container where you can be satiated without losing track, without losing a hold of your reason. It can kind of be they're extraterrestrials. They're traveling from different galaxies. It's still plausible. It's still within the realm of possibility. And I think that allows people to express that religious function in a way that is, that you know, they don't feel as shy about, I guess.
Yeah, because, and we'll get into this later on, Jung's idea in the Flying Saucers book is that even if the UFOs are real, they can still be objects of projection. And like Jung says somewhere in there, even a tin can become a fetish. You know, and natural phenomenon have become the objects of religious projections throughout time.
Right.
So what we're focusing on, at least to start here, is regardless of their factual reality, they could be real, maybe they're hallucinations, but even if they're real, we could project archetypal dimensions of our unconscious. Our needs, our greatest fears, our greatest longings could be projected onto them, transforming them into perceived angels or devils, gods, saviors, apocalyptic, bringers of destruction, whatever.
Totally. Yeah. I think I've seen that too, just on a personal level. I mean, I'm very wary of my own kind of opinions on these things because I'm going, how much am I projecting onto this? How much am I, you know, and I'll talk to my Freudian friend and he's like, well, the circle shape is, it looks like a boob, or the cigar shape is, it look like a penis. And it's like, well, yeah, the Freudian sees that, you know? And it's like, oh, I'm the more Jungian person, I guess. And I'm going, well, it's a trickster manifestation. And it's like, it's not the lines are blurred. I think you bring your own kind of opinion on it. And I think that kind of, it reminds me of the wave particle duality thing in physics, you know, where you kind of, your consciousness plays a role in what you're going to see. Or not see, for that matter.
Great. Yeah, I understand that. So just to bring us back to your article, I'm going to quote you to yourself.
Oh,
again.
Gosh. I'm sorry.
You write here that your intention, quote, is to show how mystical experiences, whether the result of religion or science fiction, might point us towards a new paradigm in which paradox, contradiction, and even irreverence can be seen as manifestations of a newly dominant archetype in the collective Western psyche. And Jung said something very interesting in this respect in the first pages of his book, too. And I'll quote Jung now. He said, "It is not presumption that drives me to write this book, but my conscience as a psychiatrist that bids me fulfill my duty and prepare those few who will hear me for coming events which are in accord with the end of an era." So I think both you and Jung are focusing in on that mythic dimension of the phenomenon. You're saying maybe what we're experiencing in the phenomenon can be seen as manifestations of a newly dominant archetype in the collective Western psyche. And Jung seems to think something similar. So I'm just curious, what do you think Jung means by this, you know, coming events which are in accord with the end of an era? And what do you mean by a newly dominant archetype in the collective Western psyche emerging in the phenomenon? Can you say more about that?
Yeah, it's a bold statement. Bold statement, Elliot. It's too much. No, I think that my dissertation work right now, the working title is Kairos of the Trickster. And so I am basically imagining modern America more and more within the grip of the trickster archetype, which has been potentially, or at least in many manifestations, dormant for quite a while. But this idea of the Kairos, this kind of opportune moment, it comes from another passage from Jung. I believe he's talking about modern art in it, but I think it applies to now, where he says we are living in what the Greeks called the Kairos, or the right moment, opportune moment, for a metamorphosis of the gods, of the fundamental principles and symbols. And then he says later on, it's up to coming generations to take account of this change, lest humanity destroy itself through the might of its own technology and science. And I really love that quote. And I kind of took it, you know, playfully, but also literally, of like, okay, I'm going to try to like imagine this particular motif as playing a bigger role than maybe it has in the past. And then that also, I think, I mean, there's a healthy amount of projection on my part, because obviously the trickster is connected to comedy and irreverence and all of that. But when you look right now around, at least here, I do think that there is a reversal, or an enantiodromia, to use a Jungian word, of our values and symbols. And I've felt it in my personal life in pretty much every register, I think. Like, I have gone from, you know, this particular mode of thinking to a totally opposite one in almost every area. And not only that, I also see in people, like we were talking before we started recording about the Daily Show interview with Lou Elizondo. I think, and then in my coming up through doing comedic news, I think people trust comedians more than they trust journalists and experts very often. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think it's happening. And I think that, you know, you have political figures that clearly have trickster-like qualities, and there's almost this distrust of truth that has been, you know, academic truth or any of that stuff. There's a kind of suspicion, and all of that kind of paints a general picture to, and AI, and, you know, all of the stuff on the internet where things, a tragedy happens and a meme pops up about it, you know, 4 seconds later, and people aren't taking things seriously very much, at least from my vantage point. And obviously it's a limited vantage point, but yeah, it just kind of seems like there is a reversal happening, and time, and this is where I get kind of, you know, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but it seems like time itself, people are feeling a sense of the wheels falling off a little bit. And I see that as kind of slipping on the banana peel, that there has been a resurgence of the trickster, basically. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily 100% true. I think it's worth exploring, because it might give context to a lot of stuff that's like happening right now that isn't so... It won't paint it in such a pathological way. We can understand these things from a perspective that has meaning attached to it, but that meaning will not look like how meaning has looked in, you know, centuries past, I guess.
Wow, that's a lot too. Well, we'll get into that. What you mean by meaning? What you mean
by
meaning looking differently than in centuries past? That's really pregnant. But I just want to agree with you about the trickster part, at least in part. I mean, the trickster blurs boundaries, you know, and we have these dichotomies with this phenomenon now that are pretty rigid and binary and set. Is it real or is it a delusion? Which one? You know, and the trickster is kind of both and, yep. You know, there's a real quality to it, and it's a psychic quality. It's not a delusion. It's not a pathology only. There's meaning in it. And you kind of put aside the question of, you know, true or false, which one?
Right.
Is that what you are getting at here?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's that. In terms of my own stance, I mean, is that kind of what you're at? Yeah. I think like I have this weird, my wife reminds me constantly that I'm a Pisces, and I do have this kind of two minds about most things. And so one thing I additionally love about ufology is this, like, I can hear the skeptic in my brain, like, loud and clear, and then he'll just kind of go away after a while. You know, there'll be an article that comes out, or the hearings, or you know, what I'm following right now is the Nazca mummies. Are you interested in that at all? That is another fascinating aspect of this, where it's like this whole field also has tricksters within it. The cast of characters alone is kind of this, I kind of want to write like a comedic movie about disclosure, just because I think that there's, the characters are just funny. I mean, you have the scientists, and you have the military guys, and then you have the scholars, and you have the experiencers, and you have the skeptics, and it has all of these archetypes within this one particular area. And so I personally always just kind of go back and forth. I find myself going, oh yeah, you gotta be nuts to not believe that this is obviously they're real. And then this little voice will go, yeah, or maybe this is all smoke and mirrors. And maybe that's the point. Like, maybe there isn't a hard and fast, like, conclusion that we're going to come to. I hope we do. That'd be cool. Or maybe I don't. And there you go.
Or as you said earlier, maybe the conclusion we'll come to will be something completely out of the binary and completely different in terms of meaning than we've known before. You know?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a UFO?
I haven't. Boy, I wish I have. You know, yeah. One time my now wife got us an Airbnb in Joshua Tree that was a UFO, and that was about as close as I've ever gotten. I don't know if you've ever seen those, like, little yurts, but it was, she knew I was getting into it. She was like, all right, come on, let's go. And I was like, maybe if I ask. But no, I've never seen a UFO. I am mostly fascinated, though, by the people who have, and the people who, like, the experiencers, because those also seem to be the most stigmatized, where people can funnel their interest in ufology solely into the kind of the government cover-up aspect. But I'm really interested in the people who, you know, they see it, you know, the mantis person or whatever. And the consistency in their stories is so fascinating to me. Like, the fact that they line up and they have the same motifs constantly is very cool. I mean, I've had weird experiences and weird synchronicities, but nothing where I go, yeah, there it is. I know my friend has, and I know people who have, but hopefully, fingers crossed. Have you?
I have never seen one myself. My wife, Monica Wickman, has seen them. I know a lot of people who have seen them. I've had dreams of UFOs. We'll talk about dreams of UFOs coming up here soon.
Great.
And that's actually what's gotten me interested in the phenomenon too, is dreams. And my son saw one, though.
Oh, really?
A few months ago.
My dad has seen one, I think. Yeah, he kind of gets a little shy about talking about it. But I'm like, yeah, no, that sounds about right.
They're kind of like ghost stories, I've noticed. If you get around a group of people and people have had a few beers or something, and someone tells a UFO story,
mm-hmm.
other people will start to
tell them. Oh, and I mean, I will stop. I'll turn the music off. I'll be like, everybody pay attention to this. We have a story right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me also of that. I don't know if you sent the quote of Jung of going, you know, the soul longs for these images. And it is, I do think that happens, because everyone quiets down and goes, hey, what happened? What was it? May I ask secondhand what your son witnessed? Was it a craft?
Absolutely. Yeah, he was flying from New Mexico to Santa Barbara. And he just noticed out the window a round metallic object flying underneath the plane, which he described as maybe 20, 30 feet in diameter.
No way.
Yeah, it just zipped by. He said he saw it for 5 to 10 seconds. You know, he had his eye on it. And it didn't create any numinous experience in him.
Oh, really?
It was just like, yeah, I saw it. But he did see one, and he's not a person who's prone to making stuff up like that.
No, I just accept people's stories as truth, because I'm not gonna waste, you know, why would you lie about it? You know, it's like the people I think who see it, it's easier for everyone to just take them at face value and go, yeah, you saw something.
Well, and I think especially in the last, like you said, since 2017 with the New York Times article, there's been such an explosion of really credible witnesses, military pilots, ex-Pentagon officials that have come out and said, for sure, these things exist, which when I was a kid growing up, I couldn't even imagine that you would see such things on CNN or 60 Minutes or the New York Times or congressional hearings. It was unimaginable. So there's that to contend with. But to get back to what you said, yeah, Jung said the soul, the hunger of the soul is sated by the vision of numinous images. And that really is the subject of your article. So I want to get back to that, subject, the numinosity of this subject. You talk about, and this is another quote, I'll quote you back to yourself, a new God image that looks vastly different from its previous iterations, that is paradoxically both material and immaterial, both outside and inside. So let's get into that. Maybe you can tell us more what you have in mind here and how the UFO phenomenon relates to what you're calling a new God image that, you know, no longer splits inner and outer or psyche and matter. It is something about the phenomenon that they exhibit strange properties. They can exhibit physical properties, so-called, and then they can become immaterial.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah. I'm thinking of Jeff Kripal here and his filter thesis, which I mentioned a little bit in the article, but the filter thesis idea relates, I think, to the other thing I was thinking of, which is this kind of a brain-breaking thing. Like it does transgress the boundaries in such a way that I think is needed right now, especially with, if you look at, say, the ecological crisis, people I think are people are very numb right now. And I think that there is a sense of either everything is meaningless or you just got to kind of make up your own meaning and it's on you and you got to kind of construct it. And it's an individual endeavor and you do it because you got to. But this is kind of something where I do think it allows people to feel a sense of something bigger than themselves without, again, needing to go to a church and follow a particular creed. Like it's a big umbrella with the UFO. And it seems like it allows for materialists, it allows for the nuts and bolts folks, and it also allows for the people who are like, you know, the more kind of new agey, the more spiritual, this is an interdimensional thing or ultra terrestrial, and you know, whatever. And so it just kind of seems really apt for the times. It seems like an appropriate thing. If I were writing, like if I was God, which I'm really not, despite what I'm accused of all the time, I can understand being like, if I want to shake these people, if I want to wake them up, you know, we got to get a new stories going. And I think that that's what's going on here, but it's not a story in the sense of pure fiction. They're going to need something that they can see and touch and feel and look at. And yeah, I think that's kind of hopefully what's going on.
Well, so if you don't mind me asking, if we just take a minute and say, okay, let's assume they're real. Like imagine one just landed right outside the door and there it is. What would happen inside of you? What's your imagination? What would be your transformation, if any, if this were really true?
Yeah,
how would it change things?
I thought I would be, prior to that article coming out about, not an article, excuse me, I saw a tweet from when they shot down the spy balloons or whatever, and they just said, you know, shot down UFO. And I remember I was actually it was Valentine's Day and I was with my wife and we were at a Penn & Teller show and we were waiting for the magicians to come out. And I see this on my phone and I did feel fear. Like I felt a kind of churning in my stomach and it was kind of I like my life. I like, you know, being around my family and I like things. We have problems, but this will upend everything. And prior to that feeling, I had always been like, come on, like we'll be fine. It'll be all right. No, there's not going to be mass panic. But I kind of, after that, was like, nope, I think there might be, because I certainly felt a tinge of, oh, what would that be? Oh, there would be fear, not of the extraterrestrials like annihilating us, but a fear of losing the stability and just kind of, you know, life changing. It was just a very kind of a pang of fear. And then there was that kind of boyish, like, boy, I hope this is, you know, something legit. So, yeah, I mean, if it landed, I would be, I would call my wife and I would be like, hey, this, you know, things are about to be different. And buckle up, I guess, because we'll see how everything else goes. Jung has a very funny thing. I think that he says at one point where he's like, if they're trying to keep this a secret because of, you know, mass panic, that's the stupidest, psychologically stupidest thing they could do. We already know about the H-bomb, and that's about as shocking as you can get, but everyone knows about it without fainting. That's actually a really good point. So I don't know that it's necessarily, though, that reality that is going to shock people. I think it will just change. Yeah, I think it would be, I think it would be highly disruptive. What do you think? I mean, I could be very wrong, but
no. Well, I mean, I'm just listening to you. I get it. I mean, what, if I understand you correctly, it would be, there would be a tinge of an apocalyptic quality to it.
Yeah.
I.e. the world as I know it just ended.
Yes. It would be, yeah, it would be a totally, it would be, you know, BC, AD. It would be like, this is, you know, or before COVID, after COVID. It would be like one of those markers where you're like, okay, we're going to have to adjust. And I think it would be, it also, even imagining that scenario kind of points to that, this sense that I think a lot of people have right now of an open-endedness and a kind of chaotic feeling. And that would, I think, you know, send it into warp drive, pun intended.
Well, that's, I mean, especially for depth psychologists, this is interesting for us. I think this is where we have something to contribute, because we are used to this in our work with clients, in our own individual lives, our own symbolic deaths and rebirths. I mean, the symbol of transformation throughout the world is die and be reborn. The death of the old thing is the birth of a new thing. You know, and as you said earlier, our culture is at a standstill. We're at a point where the old values are either dead or they don't work very well anymore. You know, Jung in 1957, I think he wrote to David Cox, he said, we're headed for universal genocide unless we can work out the way of salvation through a symbolic death. You know, and Martin Luther King said something similar a few years later. He said, America, for its very survival sake, is going to have to die to values which we've held sacred for hundreds of years. You know, consumerism,
yeah.
Militarism, racism, you know, so there's this sense, as you describe it, like, here's the UFO landed. How motivated am I going to be to just, you know, pay my taxes, watch Paramount Plus, buy my new super cool car? Wow, that could just be a kind of apocalyptic death of consciousness.
Yeah, I'm already barely motivated to pay my taxes, so that'll seal the deal. Ian McGilchrist said something similar, because we have this kind of thing, well, we need to unite, we need to come together. I mean, it's an election season right now, but also the ecological stuff, climate change. There is this idea of like, well, so how are we going to save this planet? Like, what's the point of saving a planet if we are like dead inside? Like, if we're not, we're trying to worry about out there when, so we're just going to sustain ourselves and keep this like kind of malaise going. I think that, you know, there needs to be a jolt, like they were saying. So, and I think that like coming up with this framework or finding a container outside yourself for meaning is going to be one way that happens.
That's really interesting. Well, that's a good segue into the meaning dimension of UFOs and as a psychic phenomenon, say in dreams. This is, as I said earlier, the reason I got interested in UFOs in the first place. I had some UFO dreams, you know, and I had never been interested in this type of thing ever. For me, it was just kooky and strange. Like, if weird people would go to UFO conferences, and if I brought up the subject with my friends, they would just laugh at me. And, you know, but then about 15 years ago, I'll tell you a couple dreams I had.
Please.
One is that I was in the house I lived in 15 years ago. There was a big plate glass window. And in the dream, it was night. I was in my house looking outside of the plate glass window, and there was two little aliens on the other side of the window, and they looked like aliens. Like, I mean, this is part of the ubiquity of the phenomenon.
Yeah.
If you tell a five-year-old kid, draw an alien, they'll draw one. They know what it looks like. And somehow they communicated with me in the dream. They said, yep, the government knows all about UFOs, but they're not telling anyone, because then children would not be able to sleep in their beds at night. That was the dream.
Whoa. And how did you feel when you woke up?
it was just one of those dreams from out of left field.
Yeah.
You know, and I was wondering about, like, children can't sleep in their beds at night.
That's a very curious part.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, I mean, I just wondered about it. And then it got me interested in checking out the legends, I would say, back then of UFOs. And that's part of the government conspiracy theory for sure, is the government does know about the phenomenon. And one of the reasons they're not going to disclose it is that it's going to induce mass panic. So then I had another dream about a year later. I was in my room in bed, and I had a skylight that was round in my bedroom. And this was a weird one. A being from the stars came through the skylight, went into my closet, put on a suit of human clothing, like a body, a human body, and then came out and shook my hand.
I got to get dressed first. Hang on.
I got to get dressed. So this, as it turns out, is part of the story, too, of UFOs, that they're containers for souls, or that they can take on human forms. You know, this is something I never had heard about prior to that dream.
Yeah, the kind of the Nordic, there's all the different species, you know, the Nordics and the grays and the mantises, and the Nordics can be seen or reportedly seen. Those stories get spooky real quick, especially people who believe they've seen in real life something like that. What your first dream reminded me of was, are you familiar with the name Mick West?
No.
Mick West is a very prominent skeptic, and he's kind of one of the major debunkers of UFO sightings, the whole thing. He's very, he will spend a very long time going, this is a camera thing, this is a, you know, whatever. I forget the name of the term, but this isn't a real, this is a radar blip. It's not a actual object. The whole thing is to disprove every single thing that comes across. But when he was a kid, he had a nightmare of seeing an alien land. And I think he talks about how it did terrify him for quite a while. And the idea, when you said that they said, you know, children won't be able to sleep at night, and then this guy has this dream and then grows up and becomes one of the bigger skeptics / debunkers, it seems like there's some kind of connection there.
Interesting. You know, as we're talking, it just came into my mind that one of my favorite books as a kid was Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End.
I don't know what that...
It's a great sci-fi book. It's a story. It starts off with the UFOs appear in the skies over major metropolitan cities, and they just hover there, and everyone sees them.
Mm.
And the narrator says, this is the start of a new age of human history.
Wow, cool.
Like everything, like you just said, before and after. Everything before led up to this, and now everything's new. And the title of the book is Childhood's End.
Yeah, that's a great title.
So it has something to do with the evolution of human consciousness, this image in his book.
I was last night asking my wife if she wanted to watch a movie, which she never does, and she prefers documentaries. And I was like, well, we could watch Arrival. Have you seen Arrival before? And she hadn't seen it. And I was like, well, that's a little intense right now. Maybe we'll watch a comedy. But the initial film that got me, that's kind of cemented my interest in the phenomenon, was the documentary The Phenomenon on Amazon. Did you see that? That's the Fox's second, I believe, documentary. But it was interesting too to watch that with my wife, who was only tangentially interested in the topic, because it kind of gives a view of how will kind of people who aren't familiar with this topic react to this. And she had a very kind of, okay, they're real, like, that's okay. All right, I got it. And it was kind of a done deal. And then I'm sitting here like diving into all this literature and diving into all these stories and going like, I just can't figure this out. And she's like, no, I get it. All right, you're sold. And I was like, man, wish I had that. But anyway, that's not unrelated.
No, but this is a great story because it shows the difference you're bringing out in your article between just the fact, whatever it may be, and then what we project into that fact.
Yeah.
So this is what kind of seems to me to grip you, sacred skies.
Mm-hmm.
There's the return of the sacred here for you. It's a re-experiencing of something numinous that isn't just factual. Yeah, they exist. Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Opposed to, oh my God.
Oh my God, they exist.
They exist. And what could they be? And what does this mean for human consciousness and our role in the universe and for God and our sense of meaning? And all of this psychological stuff is wrapped up for you at least with this phenomenon, sacred skies.
Totally. And I think the individualism that we kind of all have, I think, in our culture gets kind of thrown out the window when something like this happens, and kind of you have to totally have a paradigm shift. And I know as a kid, I grew up in a church, Pentecostal church, which is they're not in short supply of weird experiences and weird stuff. But then as an adult, that was when, and I mentioned in the article, seeing the shadow person and seeing, and that experience later, ironically, I talked to my former pastor about that at that time as well. And he was kind of, it was sleep paralysis, which is a classic explanation. And it probably was I'm sure that is exactly what it was. The experience of it on a firsthand perspective was not that at all. And it was quite different than some of the other typical shadow person story that you hear. But I think that also plays into my interest on it, because it's like, what was there? There are these things that happen, I think, that can punctuate our lives, where, at least for me, I can go back to that and go, I still don't get it. I still don't understand that. And then the UFO is kind of just emblematic of that, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. So we're talking about now this symbolic, psychological, what UFOs are emblematic of, at least for you, which is really interesting. And of course, in Jung's book, Flying Saucers, he's got a long section in that book about UFOs and dreams. He gives an extended commentary on UFO dreams and interprets those, as well as UFOs in modern art and interpreting what that might mean, from the psychological perspective. Literature of UFO encounters, analyzing those from the psychological perspective, not as factual stories, but as if they were dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Jung brings to bear his mythological symbolic understanding to these legends, and interprets them like you would some other fairy tale or dream or legend or myth, and trying to extract the meaning of them. But in keeping with the trickster theme of the both and, or UFOs as psychic and factual, he also has a section in his book entitled UFOs Considered in a Non-Psychological Light. And this blew my mind because I had forgotten that he had written that chapter. So here he says, I'll quote a paragraph from the chapter, because this was very interesting to me for Jung, the psychologist. As he studied UFOs for 12 years, he knows all the literature, and he's talked to government officials and military officials himself about this. So this is what he says: UFOs considered in a non-psychological light. Unfortunately, however, there are good reasons why the UFOs cannot be disposed of in this simple manner. In other words, it's nothing more than psychic phantasms. So far as I know, it ranks as an established fact, supported by numerous observations, that UFOs have not only been seen visually, but have been also picked up on the radar screen and have left traces on the photographic plate, which, boy, do we have times a thousand evidence of that today compared to 1959. It boils down to nothing less than this: either psychic projections throw back a radar echo, or else the appearance of real objects affords an opportunity for mythological projections. And then he continues, if these things are real, and by all human standards, it hardly seems possible to doubt this any longer, then we are left with only two hypotheses, that of their weightlessness on the one hand, and of their psychic nature on the other. In other words, that something psychic is endowed with certain physical properties. That blew my mind to read that from Jung.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your take on that?
I would say, and this is an ever-changing opinion, especially as kind of a newbie to the subject, but what came to mind was the Jung's later iterations of archetype as being not necessarily solely intrapsychic, but essentially being structuring, structures for all of reality that can kind of manifest at different levels. And so I see it as kind of just an incredibly archetypal experience that does bleed over into the physical reality in a very real way, not in like a kind of, oh, you're seeing something physical because it's in your brain. You're seeing something physical because it's there, because it's archetypal, because that there is a permeating, the archetype is both. We're kind of existing, I guess, in the lattice work of the archetypes, and the presence of a UFO seems like it kind of like almost like a glitch, like oops, like it's there's you can kind of there's a tricky kind of thing where they run away too, you know, the kind of they disappear and a dreamlike quality. I kind of lost the train of thought there, but I don't know. Does that make any sense? Like,
yeah, it does to me. I mean, it's in line with what you were saying about the trickster, right? The sense that are these things psychic or are they factual? And the answer is both.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
And that's akin to Jung's idea of synchronicity, in which, you know, there's a symbol in the truth of things and the material world isn't divorced from psyche as we've thought it to be in the last 500 mm-hmm. years of European civilization. And so there can be a psychic quality or an archetypal quality to this phenomenon. And also it's something you can, I'm going to tap on the desk now, experience outwardly.
Yep.
And so that would be, if I understand you correctly, the trickster thing would be, boy, does that blow apart our sense of inner and outer psychic and factual, both neither.
Yeah.
It really challenges that paradigm is what I hear you saying.
Totally. That's exactly it. I think it would break brain breaking. I say jokingly, but really the very foundations of our worldview, I think would be completely shattered in that case. But I also think that that is what is happening with, say, something like quantum physics, where, you know, and I hesitate to do that because I'm not an expert in it. And I also know that you don't want to take some other discipline and use it to necessarily justify other things. But at the same time, the Copenhagen interpretation is kind of hard to deny that there's that itself is a Copernican revolution in its own right that we haven't yet, I think, adopted or kind of caught up with culturally. Like, we still think in a Newtonian way, and the UFO seems like a manifestation of a quantum understanding of reality. Where it's, you know, I mean, I was talking to somebody about this, like, we still say sunset and sunrise, like, even though the sun never sets and never rises. And like, we are very slow, I think, to adopt new pieces of information, even when we know scientifically what might actually be going on. Our language doesn't catch up with it as quick. So I think that, you know, if you think of it as in terms of synchronicity, in terms of quantum physics or Bohm's kind of implicate order, then you can kind of, it's almost like you can sketch out a world where, okay, this is kind of, you know, this could be legit in a scientific way. We could, not legit, we could conceptualize it potentially. Have you read Immanent yet?
I haven't read the Lou Elizondo's book, but I did hear the interview on The Daily Show about his book. Yeah.
Excellent. But he has kind of a chapter in it that, now where he's kind of going through the scientific hypotheses around it and kind of how they're working on making sense of all this. And it is kind of, it's essentially, they kind of rely on quantum physics and they rely on relativity and they go, okay, this is how we can understand all of these different observables. But it still sounds very broad strokes. So that's where the skeptic in me kind of pops in and goes like, still not, I don't know. I can kind of see myself poking holes in it, but yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe this is a place to kind of end up with a depth psychological perspective, right? You know, Edward Edinger, the Jungian analyst, wrote a book, The Apocalypse Archetype, you know, and he talks in that book about how we're, as a civilization, we're reaching the end of the world as we know it, and something is brewing on the horizon. And it better, because, you know, we've got a lot of problems. And if you think of the ecological crisis and the problem of war and civil wars, endless wars, the way that our splitting of inner and outer has created an ecological problem, we could go all the way down the line, the breakdown of traditional religions. It's also cliche because we all know it so well. But this was Jung's idea, too, that we're at the end of an era here. And perhaps this phenomenon of sacred things now seen in the skies, or as you put it in your article, more specifically, numinous dimensions that can be good and bad, terrifying as well as beatific,
right?
You know, horrifying as well as salvific.
Yep.
Is appearing now as a sign that something is needed to change in human consciousness. That could be synchronistically part of the equation here. I think Jung in his book Flying Saucers said such, you know, said as much. So I guess maybe what we can do is meet back up in 5 or 10 years and revisit and see what see what's happened.
And this is the part where I take off my human suit and reveal that surprise. I also think just the transgressive nature, like I was thinking about Whitley Strieber and his the kind of archetypal note that he hit with Communion, where you got tens of thousands of letters from people, and also started the stigma of the probing, because he wrote very openly about that and his experiences of going up there and how traumatic that was. Like, some of the stories of experiencers are not pleasant. Like, they're horrible. And it that also, you know, forces us to look at our own kind of morality and look at our, you know, how we kind of view what's right and wrong. And I think that it just kind of, I don't know if there's an area that it doesn't challenge in some way and doesn't kind of transgress. And that also is a very trickster kind of quality.
Absolutely. The trickster is the antithesis of the saint, right?
Yeah.
So the trickster,
Satan for some.
For some, yeah, the trickster is like that, or, you know, the opposite of the qualities that everyone thinks is good and true. Mm-hmm. So here we are. Boy, the UFO phenomenon certainly is that. It's crazy, madness, irrational. Yep. It's sort of like the philosopher's stone is found in the shit, right?
Totally, yeah. Yeah.
Where's the new thing going to come from? And it might come from, as you're suggesting, what we've disregarded, what looks crazy, what is the antithesis of our conscious values, what no one wants to talk about. Maybe that's where the new thing is going to appear for us. That would be the trickster for me.
I agree.
Well, so interesting. Thank you so much, Elliot. Unless there's anything else you want to say or add before we stop.
I mean, I could keep talking about it for about 7 hours, but I should probably go see how the football teams are doing. But yeah, this has been wonderful. And thank you very much for having me. Truly, this has been awesome.
It's been awesome to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Jungian Perspectives, Conversations in Depth. Jungian Perspectives is presented by the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles and the C.G. Jung Study Center of Southern California. New episodes post monthly. Please visit our website, jungianperspectives.com, to learn more about upcoming episodes and look for us on YouTube and Spotify. We are a project of the journal Psychological Perspectives. To access the journal online at a preferential rate of $37 per year, please contact societies@tnf.co.uk. To subscribe to both the print and digital versions of the journal at a discounted rate of $85 per year, four issues, please go to junginla.org/media/psychological-perspectives. Jungian Perspectives is hosted by Tom Elsner, edited by Rick Such at Earshot Audio Post, and narrated by Kirsten Kairos. Funding made possible by Earthways Foundation, promoting a vision for the future that all living things can share.